Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Business.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kimberly Chow, Managing Director of Food Book Fair. We're so fortunate to work with the Museum of Food and Drink, our great partners, on yet another roundtable debate. As part of Food Book Fair 2015, we put together a roundtable about food labeling called What's in a Name? And I really have the folks at MOFAD to thank, Emma Bost and Peter Kim, for putting that one together. And it was an evolution or sort of a continuation of a conversation we had last year with a roundtable on GMOs that got really heated. And the idea was just to continue and keep talking about it. And that's what turned up.
Hi, everybody. Can you all hear me? Welcome back for our final panel of the day. Today we have MOFAD here with us, our partner who, if you don't know, MOFAD stands for Museum of Food and Drink. They have this great series called The Roundtable, and they're here with us to talk about labeling. I'm going to quickly hand over the mic to our other partner, the food stand, Mikhail, to say a couple words about what he does.
Sorry. How's it going? So a lot of you guys might have heard about food stand. If you haven't, we are a new and quickly growing food community for people who want to improve the food system by sharing the best food in their community that they make and that they find around them. So we just wanted to quickly remind you that we have these flyers all around the conference. You guys can go out and find them, sign up for our app on the App Store. It's only for iPhones at the moment, but it'll soon expand to Android. And just one reason why we support this panel, we're excited about this, is that one of the things we do is we help people understand what's in their food, what makes it good. People get to tag the kinds of food that they have in their pictures based on the ingredients and also the different places they come from, grass-fed, antibiotic-free, things like that. So we're really excited to be here.
Thank you. And now I'll hand it over to Emma Bost and Peter Kim of MOFAD.
Hi, everybody. It is so great to be here and great to see all of you. And it is a huge honor to be at the Food Book Fair. My name is Peter Kim. I'm the executive director of the Museum of Food and Drink, a nonprofit that is launching the world's first large-scale food museum with exhibits you can eat here in New York City. We want to open a global center for learning where essentially you can touch, taste, and smell your way around the world and through time and explore all the incredible connections between food and the world around us. MOFAD Roundtable, this series is meant to highlight the future role of the museum as a forum for the exchange of ideas. And it's just one of many programs that we are running. We've done everything from did a mobile exhibition based on a cereal puffing gun, and we've also done things like recreate ancient Roman feasts. But if you'd like to learn more, I'd encourage you all to go to MOFAD.org and sign up for our mailing list to stay apprised of our upcoming programs and events. And so I will now pass it over to Emma Bost, our program director, who is going to kick it off.
Thank you, Peter. Hi, everyone. Very pleased to see so many people here. I don't know how many of you were here last year, but we did an event at the Food Book Fair last spring, and we're very glad to be back. So as you know, or if you don't know already, the theme of today's talk is food labeling. And we're going to be looking at really the question of what do consumers need to know and what do they want to know about what's in their food. In the long kind of arc of food history, food labels are actually a really recent development. They in some ways date to the passage of the Food and Drug Act, or the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906, which effectively created the FDA. And at that time, what people wanted to know was essentially the same things that they want to know today. What's in their food? There were, you know, kind of misleading nutrition claims and all sorts of kind of health quackery at that time, at the turn of the century. And in some ways, those issues are still with us today, as people want to know more and more about where their food comes from, how it was made, and what its nutritional qualities are. So today, you know, we're going to be looking at some of those questions in terms of policy in particular. What, in essence, do we need to do to make our food labels perhaps easier to read for consumers? Are current food labels really adequate, or do they actually disclose too much? And should we be thinking about how to kind of rethink the regulatory framework that currently exists to take into account emerging technologies, not only genetically engineered foods, but things like nanotechnology or engineered proteins. So we'll be tackling that from several different sides today. Quickly, I'd like to just introduce the panel. We have Dave Arnold over here, who's the founder of the Museum of Food and Drink. He will be moderating. Gene Halloran, who's the director of Food Policy Initiatives for Consumers Union. Bill Hallman, who is the professor and chair of the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University. Catherine DiMatteo, who is the executive director of the Sustainable Food Trade Association and also the managing partner of a consultancy firm called Wolf DiMatteo and Associates. And finally, Val Giddings, who's a senior fellow at the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. So thank you so much for coming, everyone, and I'll let Dave kick it off now.
Thank you for coming. So the rules of the panel are very simple. We're going to start with a statement from, I'm going to go down the line, from each one of our panelists. That's going to briefly kind of state who they are, what their position is on this subject, and then we're going to pitch questions, and there will be hopefully lively discussion, after which we will have Q&A that we hope is also lively. Our general feeling is that we want to keep everything nice and friendly but spirited, so you know we won't be talking over each other or anything like that. And with that, and because if there is, then we have to, you know, we have to get mean about it. But with that, let's start. Gene, you're going to start off.
Sure. Well, thank you. I'm Gene Halloran, and I'm from Consumers Union, which is the advocacy arm of Consumer Reports, which I think most people have probably heard of. And the title of this session was What's in a Name? And I believe the allusion is to Shakespeare, who said a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. So would a food by any other name taste as good? Perhaps it would. Does that mean we don't need labels at all? Good question. So it prompted me to go and look at a couple of food labels just as examples. And so, for example, here we have two snacks, and on this snack you have your ingredients are stone ground corn, safflower oil, flaxseed, cane sugar, sesame seeds, sunflower extract, rosemary extract. On this one, it's a somewhat longer list, and you've got vegetable oil, wheat flour, soy flour, and then hydrolyzed soy protein, yoruga, yeast, paprika, partially hydrogenated soybean oil, yellow dye number 6, cheddar cheese, autolyzed yeast, yellow dye number 5, lactic acid, sodium guanylate, sulfiting agents, less than 2% silicon dioxide and calcium silicate added as an anti-caking agent. So, so I think here we may have a good example of why labeling is useful, because it can allow the consumer to choose between this product and this product, where there are a lot of characteristics that you couldn't necessarily distinguish just by looking at the package. And so what are these things that are actually on the package here? Well, first is ingredients. And you have to list ingredients and additives. So that's not just the actual food ingredients, but a whole lot of approved food additives, which are chemicals of various kinds and so forth, which are of interest to some people and not to others. But it helps consumers have the ability to choose. Then on the back, we also have nutrition labeling, a considerable amount of information required about fats and sugars and salt, which again are of more interest to some people than others. Some people care, some people don't. Oh, I'm already getting the stop sign. Okay, so I just want to add, in addition to that, not on these, are processes. You're required to label food, for example, if it's frozen, homogenized, or from concentrate, or irradiated. And we would add to that that there ought to be also the process of whether a food is genetically engineered. This is a new characteristic. And this is a highly controversial issue, but one which we feel it fits exactly within the current framework of the kinds of labels that are on food to inform them, inform consumers about the characteristics that they want to know about. Okay, thanks.
Great. So I'm Bill Hallman. I'm a psychologist. I teach at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. I am a psychologist, and I'm not the kind of psychologist that actually has patients in any sense of that word. I'm actually a social psychologist, and I study public perceptions of risks and benefits and how to better communicate those things. And I've done a lot of work around food labels, the issues of GMOs, nanotechnology in food, also health labeling, the kinds of things that are permitted. And so, you know, I think the bottom line is that for manufacturers, labeling space is really valuable real estate. And so they would like to probably put on as little additional information as they possibly could, because they'd like to use that space for marketing. On the other hand, we know that many people would like additional information on labels. So, for example, we did a study where we asked people, do you read labels? And many, many Americans lied to us and told us that they read them all of the time. We know that they don't actually. If you actually do observational studies, they don't. And then we said, okay, since you read labels, is there anything else you'd like to see on a label that isn't there now? And this is the list that we got. So at the top of the list, again, on their own, they just had to type it in. This is an online survey of 1,200 Americans, 30 seconds. Jam ingredients, 7% on their own. Country or place of origin, 6%. Clear information about ingredients, so what do those things that Gene just talked about actually mean? More nutrition information, including naming things that are actually part of the nutrition facts label now, underscoring the fact that people don't actually read the labels. And other sorts of things, less than 2%. They'd like to know whether there is the presence of allergens, whether it's gluten-free, whether it contains preservatives, whether it contains chemicals. By the way, anything chemically free is metaphysically impossible. Whether it is irradiated, whether it's organic, whether it's natural, whether it has artificial colors, flavors, or additives. There is a constituency who would like to know each one of those things. I think our question is, from that list and perhaps others, what should be compelled to be on a label and what should be allowed to be on a label? And I'm done.
Oh. Okay, I guess it's my turn.
Surprising for a full professor, but yes, I can be done in two minutes. Yeah.
Well, my name is Catherine DiMatteo, and my history with food goes back to, of course, being born, but really in terms of a food profession, I started off in food co-ops in the 1970s, and so it was the natural food movement, and I specifically want to bring that up because at the time, we sort of knew what we wanted natural to mean. Today, it's taken on a whole new a life of its own. I was in the co-op movement for many years, but I came into the organic sector in 1990 just as the federal law for labeling foods as organic was passed in Congress, so the summer of 1990. And I worked for a trade association for 16 years to get the regulations and the community to agree on achievable standards and rules to implement the legislation so that we would be able to label a production system, which is somewhat different than most labels. It was always about farming. It was about what environmental impacts farming has and how is there a different system to farm, which has been called organic much earlier than the 1970s. It goes way back to the 40s, 30s and 40s. And so we were very concerned about giving an identity to a farming system that there were practitioners around the world who felt that their identity was being stolen because other people were using the term to describe food that was not produced in the same way in these internationally accepted community standards. So this was community that went to the government and asked for a label, an unusual thing.
My name is Val Giddings. I am a passionate environmentalist. I am a backyard organic gardener. I'm a foodie. And I'm a professional skeptic, which is a term that a boss used to describe me once against someone who said I was being excessively critical of GMOs. I was asked today to offer some comments in these first few moments about what I think a label should ideally contain and what criteria should be applied to govern the contents of a mandatory label, and whether or not, and if so, how process-based claims could be incorporated into labels in a manner that makes sense from a public policy point of view. I'm personally very interested in labels for food because my son has a life-threatening peanut allergy. And so I am not among those who say they read labels but in fact do not, at least most of the time. And when I forget, my son reminds me. Because the last thing we need is to spend time in the ER or in much less attractive places that sometimes wind up being the endpoint for folks who have severe life-threatening food allergies. What should be on a label? And if you ask, as Bill just described, if you ask folks what they want on a label, people want everything on a label. If you say, do you want X on a label, 90% of the time people say yes. It's a little different if you ask folks, as Bill did, more carefully, what do you want on a label that's not there now? You get a smaller list of things. And sometimes GM pops up on that list. Sometimes it's just not present at all, doesn't emerge from background noise. But what criteria do you apply for mandatory label contents when there's no way you can fit everything on a label that everybody would want? To my mind, it's very simple. I think that labels should be required to carry information that is relevant to health, safety, and nutrition, and I think that these label contents must be policed to make sure that they are presented in a manner that is accurate, informative, and not misleading. We heard an invocation of Shakespeare. I will quote T.S. Eliot. The end result of all our exploration will be to arrive at the place that we started and to know it for the first time. Because those criteria for an ideal label look very much like the FDA policy that's in place today.
All right. Well, Gene, let me start with you, I guess. So let's say that you had no safety qualms about genetically modified foods at all. Let's just take that out of the equation for now. Would you still think it's a good idea to have labels for genetically modified foods? And if so, why?
Absolutely. And that's what they do in Europe. They have a good safety assessment system, and they still require labeling. It's to inform consumers about something they're very interested in. This is a quite new way of making food. In the laboratory, you can put genetic material from anything into anything. You could put human genes into wheat. You can put fish genes into strawberries. So this is quite new. We are hopeful that everything on the market in the U.S. is safe, but we don't have a mandatory safety assessment, so we don't know for sure. But we still think it should be labeled simply because it's different, and it's a difference that consumers care about, just like whether juice comes from concentrate or milk is homogenized. These are processes that are already required to be labeled, and so we think this belongs on the list.
So before I let it go to the other three panelists, with homogenization and concentration, presumably there are measurable and organoleptic differences. So are you saying that that's also might hold true for genetically modified, or are you saying that strictly based on a process that people want to know about that they should know about it?
It's strictly based on a process that people want to know. I think if you take frozen, for example, I think you'd have to be a pretty good trained taste tester in some cases to be able to tell a previously frozen pea from a fresh pea. Sometimes the frozen even tastes better. So it's not entirely it's a characteristic that people care about.
Just wanted to clarify before we let it go. So have at it. You want to say?
So I think that that part of the issue is people care about a lot of things. The list I just gave, those are all things people care about and presumably would want to know about in order to make a choice. The question, which on that list is most important? And what's the role of science in figuring out what should be on that label, and what's the role of public opinion? Our research suggests, and I should also say, and what are people actually bringing to the table? So I would agree with Val that the standard of being truthful and not misleading is, one of the major criteria that we should have for figuring out what should be on a label. Part of the problem about whether it's misleading or not is what people actually bring with them when they actually see the term. And what we know is that many, many people don't really understand what GMOs mean. So in our data, for example, half of Americans say they've heard very little or nothing about GMOs. More than half say they know nothing, they've read nothing. More than two-thirds say they've never actually had a conversation about GMOs. And then they would be seeing, made with GMO or GMO-free, which is currently permitted now, and what are they to make of that? So part of what we decide should be on labels has to take into consideration the interaction between what people are bringing to the table and sort of what knowledge, what information they're taking away from that label. I would also argue that perhaps contains GMOs or may contain GMOs or contain genetically engineered organisms probably isn't specific enough. So if, for example, I know a lot and I like the idea, for example, that you could create a plant with BT in it that would require the use of less pesticides. Now, whether that's true or not, we can argue that later. But assuming you like that particular benefit, but you don't particularly like the idea of genetically engineered soy where you can actually put Roundup on the ground and potentially create superweeds. All I have on the label is may contain GMOs, may contain genetically engineered ingredients. How am I to tell which of those ingredients it is, and if I want to use my dollars to promote one version or another, how do I do that? It's just not enough information. Sorry, that was long-winded. Yeah. Making up for my 2 minutes.
Catherine?
I have a complicated opinion and feeling about the whole GMO question, and in fact, I really am tired of talking about it. It sort of has dominated all every conversation in my world quite a bit. But I think that one of the things I would have to say is that we have non-GMO labels. There's a project, non-GMO verified project, that created a testing protocol. And many people are getting their products verified to that protocol. We have other people who are just making claims on their labels that they're not GMOs. And to me, what I believe is happening is that is creating a lot of confusion about what crops are actually genetically modified, because I don't think anybody would know anymore, because I do know, and I'm an informed food professional, and I see it on labels where there is not any crop related to that particular product that you're seeing on your shelf that's got a non-GMO verified or just a non-GMO claim. So my preference would be to have some regulation about it, because I think that the Wild West arena that we're in with, individually verified claims on GMO or non-GMO, in this case non-GMO, is creating a great deal of confusion, and I don't think it's serving consumers. I don't think it, from my point of view as an organic person, it doesn't serve us in the organic sector, if I was thinking purely as in a competitive way, but also in, an agronomic way. And I think that it really is leading us into, these debates about science and health and safety and all of this. And maybe it doesn't have to have a safety reason, I don't think. It doesn't have to have a health reason, I don't think. to be on a label. Sometimes it just is there to clear up confusion. And maybe it doesn't have to have a value at all. But I'm sure you would say everyone gives their own value to what they see on a label. And having experienced that with organic, that people read into organic all different kinds of things that they want. But I guess I'm advocating for labeling because there are people who want to know if it's a GMO or not. And the unregulated labeling that's gone on is creating a great deal of confusion, and I don't think it's serving anyone.
I would agree with a lot that you've heard in Catherine's comments, but I'd like to go back to the assertions that Gene made at the beginning that we need a label because genetic engineering is a new process, and with the suggestion, I think, that there may be unresolved safety issues that we should continue to be cautious about. I'm a great fan of being precautionary. I brought an umbrella today. How many of you did that? Okay. And in issues of risk management, I am a great believer in preventing risk. But I have to tell you that I think, Gene, your remarks about moving genes from one organism to another in a way that we've not had a chance to experience before are highly misleading, and not only misleading, but they're factually incorrect. In point of actual fact, the single most common gene in each and every one of us in this room today is a genetic sequence that's derived from a virus. It is, by no stretch of the imagination, a human gene. The genome of corn it consists of 50% what Barbara McClintock called jumping genes. Again, genes from that can't be called corn genes, except that that's where we find them today. They're derived from viral, from plant viruses that infected the ancestors of corn in millennia and millions of years past. Indeed, everything that genetic engineers do in the laboratory with the process called genetic modification is done with enzymes that we extract from plants that we find in nature. It's done using techniques that we have learned about because, lo and behold, we've stumbled upon them in nature. In point of actual fact, what is presented as a novel technology, genetic modification, is not novel at all. In fact, it's been nature's way since the dawn of life. As a geneticist, I can tell you every organism on the planet is, in the literal sense of the term, genetically modified. And this category of GM that is being used by some to advance the notion of a particular type of label that is being used broadly in a way that sows confusion and advances the pecuniary interests of a set of special interests is highly misleading, and the category makes no sense. From a scientific point of view, it is indefensible. And I think, therefore, that to contemplate mandating a label with that kind of information on it is to mandate misinformation. And in my eyes and in the eyes of the law, that's fraud and cannot be countenanced. I just don't think there's any way you can defend it. If a food is changed in a way that affects its material composition or the ingredients that it contains, those things are fair game for mandatory labels. Pasteurized milk, orange juice from concentrate, those kinds of things, they are process-based labels, but they have a detectable, measurable impact on the product. I don't think I would have any trouble discerning a fresh pea from a frozen pea. And yes, some frozen peas do taste better than some fresh peas, but I've eaten a lot of both, and I've never had any issue of confusion. With GM, you cannot make those sorts of claims. If the process of GM is used in a way that adds an ingredient that is relevant to health, safety, or nutrition, that is already required on the label today under existing FDA policy. I could go on, but
I'll let you, because I'll hit you on the next one, and we'll come back. This will give you a chance to rebut on that as well. We'll stay on a similar topic. Assume that you, Val, that you believe that there is absolutely no difference. It's a false category, and that the desire to not eat GM foods is a quasi-religious belief. Okay? So what? Let's say a large number of people just don't want to put it in their bodies. It doesn't matter whether or not they have the scientific facts or rigors behind them. The very small group or a group of people sizable enough to make a difference really doesn't want to use it. Isn't that enough, or does that impinge so much on kind of corporations' goodwills to have to put the label on it that it's not a viable thing to do?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it gets to the heart of some really important issues here. I am a great fan of disclosure. If there's information, I want it out there. I'm a big fan of daylight. And even in cases where people want something on a label for reasons that I think cannot be defended, I'm okay with having that put on the label voluntarily in response to market forces, as long as it's done in a way that is accurate, informative, and not misleading. I am absolutely opposed to labels that are crafted with the intent to mislead consumers. That is not, in my opinion, defensible. But voluntary labels that tell consumers or that give consumers in a variety of way the means to avoid GM if they want to, I don't agree with that mindset. But I am a big fan of allowing the market to meet that need in a voluntary manner if you can find a way to do it. And hey, guess what? The market and existing labeling provisions already provide consumers with multiple means of exercising the choice to avoid foods produced through GM today, right now. If you want to avoid so-called GM foods, you can buy organic. There are at least 8 different cell phone apps that you can download onto your smartphone that allow you to scan the barcode, in the grocery store aisles to tell whether or not the food that you're contemplating it contains ingredients derived through genetic modification or not. There are independent third-party certification agencies. Consumers have multiple avenues to choose today, right now, without corrupting the validity and reliability of the existing mandatory labeling content to require it to contain information that is not relevant to health, safety, and nutrition.
Gene, I'm going to let you start off the response thing because I know you.
Right. Well, you've heard a lot from Val here. And I don't know if I took notes on everything I want to respond to, but I think the statement that the category is indefensible is quite a statement. The entire European Union has decided that it ought to do a safety assessment of every genetically engineered food for whether there are nutritional changes, whether there are toxins introduced, or whether there are new and unexpected allergens introduced. You could say that they're completely out of their minds, but these are the sophisticated countries with sophisticated foods and drug administrations, and they have come to the conclusion that that kind of safety assessment is needed and necessary for the category of genetically engineered food. You can also say that, Val's correct about the fact that there is sometimes gene flow between species, but the definition of a species is a group of organisms that can only reproduce within like organisms. And what genetic engineering does is allow us to move genes between species. Between species. This is something that we human beings have not done. And so in a way, we're really, we're meddling here with evolution. And our view is that we should be very, very careful about it. But that speaks to the issue of safety assessment. It doesn't so much speak to the issue of labeling, except that we think that consumers are reasonable to want to make choices about whether they eat such foods or not, and that therefore this is something that should be on the label. I mean, Eric was kind of making the case that if you don't really know and can't speak in an educated way about the terms on the label, then they shouldn't be on the label. And it brings me back to this little package I was looking at. You know, I mean, how many consumers really know what calcium silicate is or hydrolyzed soy protein? But does that mean it shouldn't be on the label? I would think they should be on the label. We have an across-the-board requirement that food additives be on the label. And even if you didn't pass college chemistry and don't really know exactly what these things are.
Bill? So, Bill. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'm one of five children. I answer to any name tossed in my direction. So I didn't actually say those words that you put in my mouth, actually,
okay.
Which is not uncommon with folks. So what I was saying was, I think that when we figure out what has to be required on a label, we have to do, if we're going to create a label, we have to create a label that actually makes sense to people and is meaningful to people and takes into account what people are actually bringing to the party. So if we purposely use language that is going to make people think, for example, that GMOs, because it's called GMO, that there must be some problem with it, that is actually forcing companies to say things which are not true about their products. And we don't allow companies to make false misleading statements that will benefit them particularly. I'm not sure that we should compel companies to make statements about their products that people are going to interpret as a warning label. And actually our data does suggest that that's the way people will perceive this. So that's sort of the issue here.
Well, I think that one of the reasons that is what is likely to happen is that it's a warning label, is because the labeling issue is partially a very activist issue. There's a technology that people do not support, have in the field found problems with. Farmers have suffered from cross contamination in the fields. So part of the labeling discussion it has been to bring awareness to a new technology. And I think that we do have the voluntary labels, but I think they're, as I said, as much misleading as anything else. And you can verify whether it's been genetically modified or not. And so you can also obviously determine if it has been. So the seeds are patented. They're owned by the companies who sell them. Farmers can't save them. They can't, if they mistakenly or accidentally have cross-contamination and save seeds that show up with these unique genetic characteristics, they can be sued by the companies for fraudulently disrespecting patent, rights. So it can be, it can be determined that this is different than hybridization and the natural and human intervention that we've over the years have done, because these are being done, as Jean said, across species, not similar species being shared to have new characteristics. So I think that it's not difficult to have a criteria by which you could determine a label. And the conversation about what that label means, whether it's a warning label or not a warning label, is really going to end up playing out in the marketplace. I mean, if there was a genetically modified crop that had a benefit that people perceived as a real benefit. There's been many tried and few have succeeded. So, golden rice is probably an example that I'll throw out, especially after listening to the last last panel of talking about rice, you know, about getting more vitamin A into populations that have historically had lack of vitamin A. Personally, I think there's other ways you could solve that problem, but if that was perceived by the population as something positive and it was labeled that way, it would not necessarily be a warning sign. But to me, it would be, because I would say, I don't like this interference, this manipulation that's gone on. I do worry about its long-term consequences, not only, and totally unscientifically, I'm worried because I'm a human being. And, you know, I may just have anxiety about this. What type of risk is it? And who do I believe? So I think that the label does not necessarily have to end up being a warning label. I think that it's easy to determine which products to label because we can label the ones that are non-GMO right now. So we can join 40 other nations around the world and have labeling for genetically engineered ingredients that are in processed products.
All right. Well, since you're sick, actually, of talking about genetic modification, I'll take you off it for a minute. Let's talk about organic for a second. Okay. Now, organic, obviously, different in that it's voluntary. You put it on if you reach some criteria to say that you can produce it organically, mm-hmm. which is entirely different from, I think, interesting, and I'm actually going to pester Bill about that, the difference between voluntary and involuntary and what that means in terms of warning. But on organic, this many years later, what are your feelings on the attempt to codify a production system to protect it, and then how is that label still robust, or has it been co-opted by industry to the point that it's no longer a robust guarantee of what you originally wanted it to portray?
Be careful what you wish for. I actually don't. I believe it's very robust. I don't think it's been co-opted. I've been so intimately involved in the discussions of the legislation and then the standards and then the ongoing review processes and regulations that are, it's constantly evolving. A lot of people say, oh, it's been watered down. I hear that a lot. And that, there's no basis for that statement unless, except if you want to advocate against the fact that more companies and more farms are getting into organic. Unfortunately, not enough farms because we have a supply shortage. So there are a lot of companies, businesses, that sell products that have used organic ingredients, which have helped build a demand for organic farming around the world, not enough to actually make it effective here in the United States for some reason, but we have the lowest, one of the lowest growth rates on the farm of acreage in organic. But our yields are getting better, and that may be making up for it. So I know I'm going all over the place here. But the label has helped. It's helped grow the market. It's helped identify a production system that is different from what had evolved over time. It recognizes a number of environmental aspects, a number of agronomic aspects in the production system. It's given validity to those production systems and to those farmers. And I think from the organic label has increased people's interest in this idea of what's in my food, how is my food grown, and who's growing it. I think from the organic label being part of our marketplace now, other labels have voluntarily come up and are not regulated. The local movement, I think, would not be as robust without the organic label having been there. I think that a lot of these discussions about these heritage crops would not have increased without the fact that this voluntary label about a production system actually was regulated, is robust. There's a lot of different types of products that you can purchase that use organic ingredients and a lot of fresh product available to you. So overall, it's it's worked out pretty much the way we had expected. It wasn't perfect when it started. It will never be a perfect system, but we have a process by which we can keep debating what belongs in the organic standard regulation on the government level and what doesn't, and what outside of the regulation you can do on your own to identify yourself, even within the organic sector, as different from your other organic counterparts.
We'll go wrap around Val.
Well, I don't have a lot to say about whether or not the organic label is robust or has been co-opted. I would like to take a point of order and correct some factual misstatements. I went to the University of Hawaii for my PhD. I studied the process of speciation because the Hawaiian Islands is the best natural laboratory in the world for studying how species evolve better far than the Galapagos. And I can tell you that the suggestion that modern GM technology is different because for the first time we're moving genes not just between related taxa, but between more distantly related lineages is simply false. With conventional plant breeding, there are things called wide breeding, there's things called embryo rescue. We as humans have been moving genes between very distantly related taxa, not just closely related species, since the dawn of plant breeding, which started with Kohlreuter in Germany in the 1600s. Moving genes between very distant taxa is not something that is new, it's not something that's novel, and it's not something that's been associated with new and unusual risks or hazards. And more importantly, in nature, what we find is not just that genes move between closely related species in nature, but also between distantly related family, genera, indeed even kingdoms. The history of horizontal gene transfer, transfer between very distantly related taxa in nature, is robust, it is ubiquitous, and it happens between very distantly related taxa. And again, it's never been associated with a novel hazards or risks from the standpoint of foods and crops that we eat today. So this notion of GM as a category that justifies all the attention that is being placed on it with these proposals for mandatory labels and so forth is just nature refutes this category with every genome that we've sequenced.
All right, well, Jeannie, you're up next. Point taken that you can respond somewhat to or talk somewhat about what we're dealing with the organic and whether or not, like, labels like this, voluntary ones, end up being robust things to get you what you want. So in other words, like, in GM, it could be removing GM, but could it also be an attack on agribusiness, right, not wanting to be part of that system as well? And will the GM label actually be a robust thing that accomplishes what you want in the same way that you say the organic has actually been robust over time?
Just a couple of things I wanted to raise. I agree with Catherine that the organic label, it's been a constant struggle to keep the organic and the integrity of the organic label, but by and large it's been maintained. It is a meaningful label. It is the most meaningful label out there in our view, and we have a whole system on our Greener Choices website for evaluating labels, and it still rates very highly. In a great deal because it's verified. Unlike a lot of other labels, there's a whole system for accreditation and certification, which is extremely important. In terms of GM labeling, it will be easy to verify. If it's required by law, then you will have a system where either the government or private entities will be able to test whether it has GM content or not and verify that. On the other hand, there are other labels. There's one label in particular that we feel has become a very serious problem, and that's the natural label. You see natural all over the place, and it's completely unregulated, but consumers don't know that. We've done some polling, and in polling, consumers indicate that they believe that natural sort of is what you think from the dictionary natural means, and that it's pretty much the same as organic. And in fact, that's not true at all. It's only required. There are very few requirements, and You know, for natural meat, it can be treated with antibiotics. The meat can get hormones. It doesn't have to go outdoors. But as long as at the final stage it's not treated with any artificial colors or treated in other ways right at the end, it can be labeled as natural. And then for other products, snack products, it's even worse. So that's another issue to raise there.
What are you asking me?
Do you have a comment on this, or you want your question?
Come on in everything. I'm
all right.
A professor.
Well, give a quick comment on this, and I'll ask you a question.
So on the organic question of organics, so is it a robust label? In some respects, yes. And I would agree that it's been difficult to try and keep the standards sort of where they are or even progressing in a way that makes sense. I think the issue, though, is most consumers who would prefer to purchase organic don't actually really understand what it means. They couldn't tell you actually what those standards actually entail. There is a halo over organic. They believe that it's healthier. And in fact, our data suggests that when people buy organic, that's actually what they're purchasing. They think that they're buying a healthier product, not necessarily for the environment or for animals, but for themselves and their kids. And it's extraordinarily frustrating to me. I live 2 miles north of Princeton when some of my relatively affluent neighbors get into their very large SUVs and will drive 7 miles to get a quart of organic milk because it's better, you know, it's healthier for them. You know, the environment be damned. So, again, sort of, what are consumers bringing to this? What are they cueing? What does organic trigger for them? What does GMO trigger for consumers? And as a professor, whose job is it to help educate them so they actually understand what these things actually mean?
We're running low, so I'm going to ask you a question that's more of a comment, because in his role as advising to regulators, he's not supposed to provide straight-up opinions. He's not an opinion piece.
Plenty of opinions.
Yeah, not that he will share. My question is this. I mean, it seems what's interesting here is, as opposed to organic, like the kind of GM argument that's going on here, the question is whether or not it should be mandatory versus voluntary. And I think the interesting difference between organic and genetically modified is that someone could choose to buy organic when they want and not necessarily buy only organic foods. And so it needn't be on everything, right? The label needn't be on everything. Whereas there is a group of people who never under any circumstances want to consume genetically modified foods, whether it's for good reasons or whether it's for incredibly not good reasons. So where do you, when you're talking to people who are regulating, where do you weigh the benefits to that group, which is they don't want to consume it in any form, versus the, it seems to me, actual damage of this negative valuation that's going to happen with genetically modified label for corporations and other consumers?
So as a way to answer that, I'm not sure whether the camera can pick up the audience. How many of you have eaten a genetically modified food? Raise your hands.
Today?
Everybody, raise your hands. You're all eating GM foods. You're eating foods at least derived from ingredients that have a GMO origin. And one of the problems that we have with GMO labeling is about half the sugar, for example, used in the United States comes from sugar beets. About 95% of all the sugar beets are GMO varieties. Most people don't actually know that. So if you're actually buying things with, you know, real sugar in it, thinking that you're actually avoiding things that are unhappy, there you go. But the deal is that when you are looking at sugar beet sugar, there actually is no DNA in it. That would actually be a contaminant. It would screw it up. So is sugar from a GMO sugar beet a genetically modified ingredient if there's actually no genetically modified DNA in it? So how do you answer that?
Also, have
no.
you...
No.
Have you...
Well,
I,
so,
yes.
Right. So that was sort of a rhetorical question, not an upfront question.
There are data.
Yeah. So, I mean, this, and the same is true for most oils.
There could be allergens.
Have you... Well, to that point, have you polled people on a plant modification through seed irradiation?
People would have no idea what we're talking about. Do you know what we're talking about, seed irradiation? So GM, the traditional way of doing genetic modification prior to our current abilities was to expose plants, for example, to large amounts of radiation, essentially scrambling the DNA material there, seeing what you get, and sort of growing it out. Is that GMO? Is that genetically modified?
No.
So why not?
Because you're not introducing something from outside the genome.
But that's really a new technology. If your standard is we should label things which are new technologies, well, maybe that should count.
Just for clarification, though, you're like literally just blah, 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 blah. Like, so it's like not that it's from a different creature. It's just from a non-creature. It's totally like zorched.
Let's blast it and see what we get. Yeah.
But you think the fundamental difference between a planned intervention versus an unplanned intervention.
I mean, you could argue it the other way. I wouldn't be against labeling products that had that kind of treatment, but I don't think it's necessary, and I don't think it necessarily falls within this larger category of genetically engineered.
So part of the issue here is when we do our research, we'll do surveys, we'll do open-ended interviews, we'll do mental modeling interviews. And when we ask people about these kinds of things, their sense of what's actually involved, they're holding up a sign saying
they're going to make us do Q&A. We'll finish what you're
Sorry.
Saying.
I'll let it go. Let's go ahead and do the Q&A part.
Right, you want to go to Q&A? Yeah. All right, we want to go to Q&A. We have questions from the audience. Remember, germane questions. Questions, hopefully not comments.
What's that?
There's several hands up. It's hard to see.
Very high pressure way to ask a question. I have two questions. So the first is, most consumers, I think, are fairly undereducated about what fat and salt means on nutrition labels. Like, I'm pretty well educated and don't actually know how many grams of fat the USDA thinks I should be eating every day, or the FDA. So are you advocating, if the consumer doesn't understand it, we should pull it off the labels? So that's the first question. And then the second question is, what can we learn about how the National Organic Standard process happened that could inform how a genetic modification label would work? So
two good ones.
So I'll answer the first one, which is no. I think that information that should be relevant in terms of preventing risk or promoting health should be on there. And we need to help consumers understand actually how that information can be used to do that. But that's not the same thing as mandatory labeling of GMOs or nanotechnology or irradiation or anything else.
By the way, in the Q&A, not everyone need take a crack, but you can if you want.
I think the interesting part of the question, related to what can we learn from the organic label and how it was adopted, that may be relevant to the idea of mandatory GM labels. The organic label is a marketing tool. An organic label, in fact, tells you nothing about the nutritional qualities or the safety of anything that bears that label. It's just that's not what it's designed to do. It is purely a process-based label and designed to inform folks that this item was grown with a particular set of practices that allow certain things to be done by the farmer and that prohibit the use of certain substances and allow the use of other substances. If you were to apply those sorts of criteria to the idea of a mandatory GM label, you'd abandon the idea of a mandatory GM label because the organic label's not mandatory. And I could go on, but I'll stop.
Are there other questions?
By the way, while we're waiting for the next question, I'd like to recognize that Assemblyman Lentil came to this panel today, so from this district, deals with these kinds of issues, so your legislators are listening.
There'll be a quiz later.
So with genetically modified foods, you're introducing particular aspects to the genome. would those be considered ingredients? Would you consider those listed as additives, food properties, other types of things?
Are you asking in a label, would you just add, for instance, BT as the extra protein that's added to it as an ingredient? Is that the question? Or?
Well, BT, or I hear you use E. coli to break down the cell walls of genetically modified plants to introduce genes. Any of these things that are introduced, the actual gene themselves, so people could become familiar with the genes that are being introduced.
Well, all the genes that are newly imparted to crops that have been improved through biotechnology are a common part of our diet anyway. Some will say that the BT, the Bacillus thuringiensis protein that kills certain insect pests, has not been part of our diet. You know, it's derived from a soil bacterium. This soil I could take one shoe from anybody in this audience, and I could extract Bacillus thuringiensis bacteria from plating out the contents of the shoe with a swab. And you could do that all around the world. This bacterium is ubiquitous. And we know what happens when humans eat the protein that's derived from the gene that we got from this bacterium. It serves as nutrition. It's broken down in our digestive tract by hydrolytic digestion, just like any and every other protein. So it's nutrition, and it's not a nutritional difference that makes a substantially different food product to trigger the requirement for a label if something has actually been added that wasn't there before that FDA already applies. So, you know, if you were to use genetic engineering to add to a crop plant a gene that encoded for a protein that was novel and that was associated with the potential hazard. For example, if you tried to improve the nutritional quality of a soybean by inserting a gene from Brazil nuts that helped improve the nutritional quality, then you would want to make sure that you put that on the label because some people are allergic to Brazil nuts. And in fact, Pioneer Hybrid pursued exactly this approach to try to develop a soybean better suited for chicken feed. They discovered that in putting that Brazil nut protein, they had transferred the allergenicity of Brazil nuts, and so they abandoned the product. But had they moved forward with it, that chicken feed would have had to carry a label saying this contains material from Brazil nuts and may be allergenic.
Could I comment?
Yeah.
It is my understanding that that particular Brazil nut would not be required, Brazil nut soybean, would not be required to be labeled.
That's not correct. It would.
Under allergy regulations.
Absolutely.
But not
absolutely.
Under, right. Not yet, right. I mean, it's a question.
Then there's a, oh, yeah. So actually we originally thought and petitioned the FDA to classify genetically modification as food additives, because it seemed it's just a different way of inserting new material into a food. For example, you could insert a gene for caffeine production into a food. If you put caffeine into a food as an additive, it has to be labeled. Would it still have to be labeled here? Not altogether clear.
No, it's but very clear.
It's very clear, actually.
You might have to label that caffeine was present, but you wouldn't have to label how it got there.
Correct.
Right. But on the allergy issue, there are, in fact, hundreds of substances that different people are allergic to. And have the same sort of allergic reaction as some people do to nuts. There are 8 common allergens that FDA requires labeling of, but I know someone who was allergic to bananas, and I know someone else who was allergic to avocados, and have the same kind of reaction, severe reaction, that people have with peanuts that can send them to the hospital. What if a protein from an avocado were introduced into soybeans? Would there be a requirement for assessment for allergenicity? No, we do not have that requirement in the United States. There's a voluntary program that FDA runs, and all the companies say that they adhere to it, but it's only voluntary, and we have now foods being developed in other countries. We don't even know if we have imported foods that are genetically engineered. And we certainly don't know if they went through any safety assessment process. So there are concerns. We do think, actually, that that allergens, and especially uncommon allergens, would be an important reason to have labeling of genetically engineered food so that anybody who had such a sensitivity could identify their reaction.
Is part of the problem here that no one really understands how things get from the genetic modification to the market in the U.S. because so many different administrations have to touch it, and that there's no really kind of knowledge or transparency of what the testing is or whether it's voluntary or mandatory on different bases?
Well, I'm not sure that there's any lack of transparency. I mean, the...
Or knowledge, I mean, among the general...
People don't... There's a lot that people don't understand about how their food finds its way from the farm to their fork, and it's not just limited to these issues that we're talking about, which some of which are admittedly esoteric. But it's really frustrating to hear these assertions made about allergenicity, because there is only one category, and setting aside that it's a bogus category, there's only one category of foods anywhere in the world that is subjected to any kind of pre-market analysis, voluntary or mandatory, that screens them for whether or not they are potentially allergenic. And that's with foods derived from crops improved through biotechnology. Organic foods go through no pre-market safety assessments whatsoever, and they are associated with a substantially higher frequency of foodborne illnesses than conventional or others. The CDC data show this. This is very clear. Read the news reports on a weekly basis. This is not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of fact. You know, so it's very frustrating to hear these claims made about potential allergenicity. I can tell you that there is an issue that relates to allergenicity in foods derived through biotechnology. And it is, as I mentioned, this is important to me because of my son, okay? The issue is that biotechnology offers us, for the first time in human history, the opportunity to address these potential hazards from food allergens in a way that would protect my son and people like him from food allergies. There are researchers working to eliminate from peanuts the genes encoding the proteins that elicit the allergenic response. Okay, that would be an elegant solution. The same kind of solution is being pursued with respect to dairy products, to soy. You know, it's possible to imagine ways to eliminate those allergenic proteins from the food chain now that we could never have managed before. It's also possible to imagine therapeutic interventions that could treat people who are allergic to remove their allergic sensitivity to these allergens. So the truth on this issue is exactly the opposite of what the common understanding is, because some folks have chosen to use fear as a way to expand their market share by suggesting that there are hazards associated with this category of GM foods when, in fact, there are not.
Well, we could do this all day. But are there any more questions on labeling, or are we...
I think we're actually pretty much out of time for questions at this point.
All right, also, then everyone's going to get some time to wrap up. This is not like this. And we'll go... figure out which direction we'll go. We'll start this way, and we'll go that way. Jean, we'll start.
Well, something we haven't touched on is sort of how this relates to democracy. And it seems to me that that when you have a significant concern and people want labeling, this is something that we can address through our democratic processes and should be able to address through our democratic processes. And we have, for example, a bill to require labeling of genetically engineered food pending in the New York State Assembly. And we believe that it should pass, but the people, through our democratic means, will decide that. And I think that that's an entirely appropriate approach to the question. It's very good to have all this debate. And people can make up their own minds, and ultimately, it should be a democratic choice.
Wow, we've talked about a lot of really, really important things today. We've barely touched, you know, the surface of this particular issue. So I'm obviously in favor of democracy. I'm also in favor of a scientific approach to figuring out potential risks and benefits of the kinds of things that are in our food. And given that if we left it completely to public opinion, we would have every one of those things on my long list forced onto a label, we have to have some way to figure out how to choose from among them. It seems to me that science is a good way to go to figure out whether there are actually truly risks, truly benefits to the kinds of things that are there, as opposed to whether people just want it there.
Well, it's a very complex issue, obviously, and some people have more scientific knowledge than other people. I am always reluctant to rely totally on science. I don't think science is perfect either. I think it's an art, not a science.
Science was perfect.
And we rely a lot on that, though. That argument, we don't have to get into a debate. Anyway, this is our wrap-up. So what I would like to say about labeling is that labeling, voluntary or mandatory, there has to be transparency about what it means. And I think that there is always going to be a group of people who really are motivated for their own reasons or for health reasons, like people with allergies, who will do the research, will educate themselves about what that label actually does mean. And then they will, if it matches their value system, because some of it's just value-based, if it matches their health needs, that's great. But whether it's mandatory or it's voluntary, there has to be transparency by those who are making the claims, the labels, about what they're, you know, what it is that they're, the accuracy of those statements. Because I think that labels can be very misleading. They are very misleading. In food, we have a lot of labels. Every package is a billboard, practically. You don't see that. You don't see that on an appliance. Do you go to buy an appliance, a refrigerator? It's not a billboard of different labels. I mean, there are some Energy Star, you know, ratings and things like that. But you don't get this, you know. A whole array of things that you can choose from about that particular, like where did the metal come from that made the refrigerator, and you know what happens, you know, at the bottom end of it, what happens to those heavy metals or the plastics in it when you dispose of it, or you know, can you recycle it or can't you? So I think that for some reason, because food, we all have to engage in food, and it's it can harm us. And we have put values on food, some of which are cultural, some of which are historic, some of which are newly learned. And so for me, my pitch is that, yes, do read labels. And when you see something that you don't understand, try to get a balanced opinion. And, you know, push some of the companies that are actually putting the labels on. What do they know about the label? And what do they know about the ingredients that they have in the product?
Democracy. Winston Churchill said of democracy that it's absolutely the worst form of government, except for all the others. I think he was right in that. But on this issue, I'm happy to point out that there is an elegant and beautiful democratic solution to this problem that does not compel folks to put something on a label that is not accurate, that is not informative, and that is misleading. And it is that consumers right now are fully empowered and enabled through multiple pathways to exercise their freedom of choice and cast their economic ballots for foods that contain ingredients derived through genetic modification, this bogus category, or to avoid them by any of the means I've already enumerated. In my talks on this topic over many years, I've come to the point where I feel impelled to point out on occasion that the only thing I think that humans are less rational about than food is sex. Because, like sex, food is tied up with the core of our identity, and the fundamentals of who we are and where we came from and what we hope to pass on to our kids. Food is extremely emotional. And that's why I think I'm such a big fan of transparency in this area, but I think also that science is in fact limited, but it's the only discipline that we have out there that makes as its central tenet correcting itself. And therefore, it provides us with a pretty reliable yardstick of how to avoid avoidable errors. And on the issue of food safety and nutritional content and things like that, we have a plan in place that works pretty well. All the things that advocates of mandatory labels for GM food claim they want, that they need a mandatory provision for, are already available to consumers. And I would encourage you all to go out and use whatever means that you choose to exercise your freedom of choice and cast your economic balance for the foods that you want.
All right. Now, do not take the order of speaking as an endorsement. The museum endorses none of these opinions. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to our distinguished panel. Thanks to the Food Book Fair. I hope you all enjoyed it.
As a final note, you might have noticed that there are some small surveys in your programs. If you could take 15 seconds to fill them out, they're very short. We would appreciate it very much, and then there will be people at the door collecting them on your way out. Thank you.
And one more final note, please join us up in the main event space to toast to all our great panels and conversations as we continue them throughout the weekend. Thank you all.